Progressive presents Mind Flowness with Flo.
Before you lies a beautiful meadow. In that meadow, Progressive Direct has placed its auto insurance rates alongside those of competitors. You select the lowest rate and feel a great sense of calm. A great sense of...
Compare Progressive Direct rates with competitors' rates so you can rest easy. Visit Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Hope Illuminated Podcast, your source for the stories, science, and strategy of suicide prevention and mental health promotion, where we live, learn, and work. I'm your host, Dr. Sally Spencer-Thomas, and I'm on a life mission to empower communities with solutions that help people overcome isolation and despair and rekindle a passion for living. Each episode, we're joined by international experts who inspire hope and offer real guidance. Welcome to the show. I am so grateful that you're here. Today, we are talking about a really important topic, and that is about communication and storytelling related to suicide prevention and mental health promotion. And this is such a timely topic for a number of reasons. I think in the last few months, it's been really piquing our interest on how to communicate these things through with the experience of the Netflix series, 13 Reasons Why, that came out. I think that got a lot of parents talking and teachers and students. We had a number of high-profile suicides that got the media focused on this issue. And in some ways, you know, it's good that we're bringing this story out of the closet, but a lot of those examples also brought out some unsafe communication strategies that might actually lead to more harm. In fact, we have learned that when we talk about suicide in unsafe ways, the incidence of what we call contagion or copycat effect is much more likely. So if we glamorize it or romanticize it, or we talk too much about the details of the means or create these like romanticized fantasies about it, like the premise around 13 Reasons Why with this revenge fantasy, all these things can lead people who are vulnerable to potentially over-identify with the suicide and then imitate it. And so that's something we really want to avoid. And then there's a whole bunch of language things around suicide as well, in particular, that we become more mindful of as we become more interested in how we shift the conversation that we're having around suicide. So you won't hear me use the phrase committed suicide or successful suicide or unsuccessful attempt or even completed suicide, because all of those phrases imply something that's really counter what we're trying to talk about with suicide. So obviously there's nothing successful about a suicide tragedy. So that language always makes me incredibly uncomfortable. But most people also don't know that the phrase committed suicide actually emerged from a place where suicide was thought of as a sin and a crime. So when I learned that, I worked really hard to get, you know, eliminate that phrase from my language and came to a place of using this phrase, completed suicide. Well, that's really not a lot better in that it still implies that you completed a goal, you reached a goal, and so forth. So most of us now use the phrase died of suicide. And in fact, if you swap out the term suicide for cancer, and if it sounds weird, it's probably not the best phrasing. So we don't say committed cancer or successful cancer. That sounds bizarre. But we said the person died of cancer. And so these are some like preliminary tips on how to best communicate in safe and effective ways. The other thing that's really important about our conversation today is that storytelling is such a critical element in shifting people's hearts and perceptions. Because suicidal thoughts and mental health conditions like depression and anxiety are hidden mostly from people's view, right? So we don't see people walking around with bandages or broken legs or anything where we can give them empathy and support. Most of this is hidden. We tend to project all kinds of images and stereotypes onto people who are living with these things. And the people living with them often are shrouded in silence and shame and so forth. And what we've learned about storytelling, and our guest today will help us with many more of these thoughts, is because she's done such an incredible job in her storytelling ability, is that we find that we're not alone. Like, we can start to build a community when people come out and share their stories and connect with one another on this really powerful level. Stories also help us create a roadmap. I call it a roadmap to hope. You know, if I can see someone similar to me finding their way out of this darkness or struggle, I have hope that maybe I too can find my way out. And then there's really been nothing that has paralleled the, come even close actually, to impacting stigma reduction better than storytelling. Building relationships, in fact, person who has any kind of stigmatized or marginalized condition is the most powerful thing, because when we do that, when we share our humanity with one another, we have this sense of we're far more similar than we are different. And all of our misperceptions and stereotypes start to melt away. So there's really an art and an arc to storytelling that's also effective in shaping people's thoughts about this, and I'm hoping our guest today can help us think about how to do that as well. So without further ado, it is my distinct honor to introduce our guest today, Lisa Klein, and she's an award-winning director and writer who's just dedicated so much of her life to crafting groundbreaking and emotional documentary features and media projects. In 2012, which is when I believe we first met, Lisa co-directed the award-winning film Of Two Minds. And this is a powerful documentary about a journey of the lives of remarkable people who are living with and struggling and triumphing over bipolar condition, which is something really near and dear to my heart. So to those of you who know a little bit about my story, my younger brother took his life after what I call, you know, a fatal fight with bipolar conditions. So bringing that out of the closet really means a lot to me. After this film was launched, it played across the U.S. and Canada at dozens of film festivals and theatrical showings, universities, many other social presentations, and it received a number of awards, the EIC Prism Award and the SAMHSA Vision Voice Award are two of the highest awards that come for mental health filmmaking in the United States. So it's just a huge honor. And then it was acquired and now has been distributed and well-received through Netflix and iTunes and Amazon Digital. And she still tours today across the country to raise awareness and share this film through screenings so that people have a better sense of what that experience is like to live with the manic highs and the devastating lows of bipolar condition and other mental health issues. She's been honored to be present at the Mayo Clinic, the International Society of Bipolar Disorders Conference, the National Convention for NAMI, which stands for the National Alliance for Mental Illness, and so on. But more recently, Lisa and I had the opportunity to work a little bit together, and I'm a huge fan of her current project called The S Word. And this is a documentary that tackles, you know, this really unfathomable, daunting, and cloistered issue of our time, suicide. And she does such an amazing job of sharing these emotional stories of suicide attempt survivors and loss survivors. And I got to see a sneak preview at the American Association of Suicidology's national conference in Phoenix just a few weeks ago. And I tell you, I'm sitting in the front row and I am surrounded by my colleagues, several of whom are in the film. And we are crying, we are laughing, we are hugging. It was so powerful. So I'm so pleased to have my little tiny 5 seconds of fame in the film. And I'm so proud to be supporting this project. Lisa and her film team actually came to Denver in the spring, or I guess it was February or so, of 2016 to do some of the filming on site at a conference that we were having here called Elevating the Conversation, where we focused the whole day on helping mental health service providers better understand how they could serve their clients who were living with suicidal thoughts by listening to people with lived experience. So we had up on our stage and at the podium several people who had come through a suicide attempt or live with chronic suicidal thoughts, share their stories of what works in therapy, what is helpful and what is not. And so a little bit of that is in the film, too. So Lisa's joining us from her home in Los Angeles, where she, where her company, MadPix Films, is housed. She lives there with her husband and MadPix partner, Doug Blush, and their daughter. So without further ado, Lisa, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. And Sally, if I could just take you with me everywhere I go to do the intro, because you make me sound so awesome.
You are awesome. You're completely awesome. And like I said, I've seen the film now 1.5 times. I had to leave early to take a kid on the second screening. And I am so excited about where this film is going to take people in being a far more compassionate an empathic community, and also hopeful that there are many things we can do to bring people through this darkness. So let's start at the beginning a little bit. I know you and I have some tragic shared history with what got us to this passion. Could you share a little bit about kind of what those life pieces were for you and how you got, you know, to be in this place of caring so much about these issues?
Sure, absolutely. Both my father and my brother died by suicide, and this was when I was in college, so it was a while ago, and I went through certainly the shame and all of the stuff and did not talk about it, only to my close friends, and it pretty much ate away at me, and I realized that, again, it was not an overnight epiphany to suddenly say, oh, let me write about this and do a film about it and really be open about it. No, it was sort of the opposite. And I just really, again, could talk about it with my close friends. But beyond that, when people ask me how my brother died, for example, it would be, well, it was cold, it was Michigan, it was winter, all true. And I left out some important things like, you know, he was in the car in the garage and you know, it just things like that I couldn't deal with then. And so over the course, you know, after going to film school and all of that, just sort of bursting with, I have to tell this story. I have to sort of come out and talk about this and let other people talk about this. So
was there a turning point for you? Was there a mentor or a moment? Could you set the scene for us a little bit when you had that epiphany? Do you remember where you were or kind of what was going on for you?
If I had to put a time stamp on this, it would probably be when my daughter was born. Because I think that was 15 years ago. And I think I realized then, I mean, when I think about, I don't think they were lies. I think they were omissions. It sort of depends how we want to present those. But, you know, just a lot of stuff was not talked about in my family. And there are a lot of things that I don't know still. And when my daughter was born, again, I don't know that it was that moment or, you know, but again, because I've really been reflecting on this a lot over the past couple of years, like when this happened, when the turn, because I don't think it was an overnight thing, but I just in talking to people and talking about this, and I realized I can't keep these secrets anymore. I can't do this. Just doesn't seem like that it's going to be good for anybody. And I realized that, you know, as a filmmaker, as a storyteller, I'm not the only one going through this, even though oftentimes when you are going through it, you do feel like the only one. And you can't believe that anybody has dealt with things that you've dealt with. And I really wanted to find this stuff out, and I really wanted to sort of, and I realized that in exploring this, I would have to tell my story, because it isn't fair to be interviewing people and have them just tell us everything that has gone on with them, and about their, whether it's about their suicide attempts or them dealing with various, you know, levels of bipolar, whatever it may be. I realized that if they ask me, I have to tell them too. So it was sort of all of that, I think, was
I resonate with
the turning point.
So much. Yeah. I mean, I know what our family went through with losing one immediate family member. I can only imagine the devastation, confusion, all of that with losing two. And I had a similar, so I want you to maybe comment on that for a moment. And then I also had that experience when I started having children that, now my brother died after my kids were born, but I had this experience as they were little of, you know, it stops with me. I have to be able to make sure that they understand the risks of the genetics that are in our family, that they understand that I'm here for them, and, you know, that we're going to do everything in our power if they are having a similar struggle. I just wanted to stop, you know, any kind of silence. So can you speak a little bit about that to the, you know, the two family members, and then also kind of the next, you know, the next generation, your impact on your daughter?
Absolutely. Well, with my father was first, and then my brother was 3 months later. So I think the way that it impacted me, well, in a lot of ways, but I think, and I called it sort of the waiting for the other shoe to drop, which I guess is now labeled PTSD, but it's one of those things that whenever the phone rang, it'd be like, oh my God, what's next? Because it was after my father died, and I was in college and just trying to figure things out. I mean, I had come back, and also I was not told, I did not know that he died by suicide. I didn't know this for a couple of years, which is a whole other story, but I did eventually find that out. But when I came back to school and started, you know, reacclimating and, you know, hanging out with my friends and doing that, and then the phone rang and then it was my brother, then I realized, okay, how am I going to do this? What am I going to do? How am I going to even, you know, move forward the next day? And it took a while to kind of, you know, sort of wade through all of that and try to see that life was not going to be a series of, when is the phone going to ring next? Who's going to die next? Who's going to, you know, that took a little bit of therapy. With my daughter, it became about, when am I going to tell her? Because it wasn't if, it was going to be when. I had to tell her about, and I was just trying to think, you know, what is age appropriate? Certainly not one, or two. And I think, so she's 15, I think it was about 4 years ago, and I told her about my brother first, because that, it's weird, it's one of those things, but like, how do I tell her about my dad? I mean, she has a dad, and so how was I, you know, so with my brother, again, it was, you know, like at night, we were together, and, you know, it sort of came out, because she had asked before, and I said he died, there was something with his brain, and he died, and I, you know, with my father, I said his heart stopped, true, because when you die, your heart stops, and my brother did have something going on with his brain, so nothing was an actual lie, it was just, again, omission, when she was really, really young. And then I realized, no, I'm gonna tell her. So I did, and then I waited a couple of months to tell her about my father, because again, she was like 10 or 11, and the first one was hard enough, and the second one, you know, it was like, hey, guess what? Your grandfather and your uncle, they both died. How? By suicide. So it just did not seem like the right approach. So I really thought it through, and then I eventually told her about my dad too. And that was really, really hard, because it had to be coupled with, you know, her dad had to be there and you know, just reassuring that he was going to be there and I was going to be there and all of the stuff that goes with that. And how do you do that?
Great. And so, I'm going to just pause for a second there and say that in the show notes, I will add a couple of resources, because I know your family and my family are the only ones that have struggled with how do we tell the kids. We don't want to lie. We don't want to keep it a secret. But it's overwhelming information for adults. Kids can't even process death, let alone something like this. And so resources like the Dougie Center and Judy's House have really given us some roadmaps to do exactly what you did, Lisa, to find age-appropriate ways to talk about this with children and really just kind of meet them where they're at and give them the information in bits and pieces as their brain develops and they're able to kind of process right. and integrate things into their life. So thank you for that. So tell me a little bit more about Of Two Minds and how that project got started and kind of what that whole experience was like for you.
So with Of Two Minds, so the thing that I haven't, and again, I'm not trying to omit, but again, it's a lot, is that my sister, during my childhood, she was diagnosed with bipolar, and she was 11 years older than me. So again, I thought that she's had a really big personality. She was super funny, super smart, super just all over, you know. And then when she died in... she died in the 90s, and again, it was not something that I necessarily dealt with great, but over the course of a few years, it was 2004, I think, something like that, 2008, when I was reading the New York Times, and I was reading about somebody who was dealing with bipolar and how she was, like, writing these articles and doing these YouTube videos. There was all this stuff. And I just sort of, okay, I'm going to do a film about this. I have to deal with this. So it wasn't like this altruistic, oh my God, I'm amazing. It was more like, I have to figure this out. And so I'm going to investigate. And in the course of that, that's sort of how that film kind of got made. And like with any sort of project, whether it's written or a documentary or anything, what it starts out to be and what it becomes are two very different things. Same with the S word.
Yeah, and for me to be, you know, kind of watching from the wings as you put the S word together and then watching it up on the screen, part of the emotional experience for me, and I can't even imagine what it was like for you, is to say, I know those people, and I've been, whose stories you're telling, and I've been with them in the past 3 years that you've been making the film, and I remember when her hair looked like that, and I remember when, you know, this happened to him, and just the connection with them. Can you talk a little bit about kind of your relationships with some of the people in your movie and how that impacts you as a filmmaker and the storyteller of their stories?
Absolutely. There's always a fear. I mean, when you do a film like this, it's like, you know, the first thing is how am I going to gird myself up? Not that it's about me, but I can't lose somebody. We can't lose them. You know, we can't lose somebody, and we're talking about a very vulnerable population. But when I went into this and finding people too, you know, like it became really easy, because at first it was, you know, just I found Desiree Stage. She was doing she's got a website that about photographs and how she photographs people and interviews people who have attempted suicide. So that sort of started, and it kind of snowballed from there, just in terms of getting people and all of that. But what happens in the course of this, as I said before, is that when you are talking to people about the most intimate parts of their lives and the most tragic, and you can't, it is not a one-way conversation. So when I'm asked, you know, what my story is and all of that, it just became a dialogue. And I was with these people for over 3 years on and off, and, you know, flying back and forth and being with them. And I have become very close with pretty much everybody in the film. I mean, they're because again, when I do a film about a subject like suicide, it isn't like, okay, made the movie, see you guys later. It just doesn't go that way. I will be in their lives, and they will be in my lives in my life. I only have one that I know of forever. So, you know, I want to keep that. And my dog is barking. I have to say that I'm going to go somewhere else. Sorry about that. So I do want to say that toward the end of filming, and it's really hard to decide when it's going to be the end of filming, because it isn't like people's stories stop. You know, they continue, and things continue to happen and all of that. So when we decide, you know, we got to a point where it's like, okay, you know, we could just keep doing this and keep doing this and keep doing this, but we made it a point. And what I wanted to do at the end, I called it sort of my immersion tour, where I actually stayed with some of these people because I wanted to be with them, like before they went to sleep at night, when they woke up in the morning. I really wanted, whether that's, you know, I know that a psychiatrist or psychologist can't do that. That is something that, you know, documentary filmmakers don't quite have the same boundaries. And so I just thought that, you know, I thought that it would serve the film and serve people watching the film to really see them at their most vulnerable and really let them tell their stories.
Absolutely. And that totally came through, the level of trust that they had with you and their willingness to really fully participate with you and the camera. Very evident. So again, in the show notes, we'll add links to Desiree Stage's Live Through This resource with her photojournalism and her blogs about people who've lived through suicide attempts, and kind of, you know, you can see her communication strategy and how she tells those stories, and as well as Craig Miller's book, This Is How It Feels, and his own memoir of living through his suicide attempt. So thank you for that. Is there any other piece of your narrative of coming through your loss into engaging into this life-saving, life-changing, culture-changing work that you'd like to add? What else fuels your passion?
Well, I would say that when I went into this film, like when I decided that, when we decided that we were going to make this film, I say, it's funny, like, yeah, I did this all by myself. But going into it was, I really did come at it from the angle of somebody who had lost somebody to suicide, somebody who had lost people who I loved to suicide. And what I found in the course of these 4 years now, was sort of this thriving community of people like Craig and Leia and Kelechi and Dez and just everybody who had attempted and survived and what they're doing now. And it just, you know, to answer the questions, to sort of see what would bring somebody to that point, which again, it's very different for everybody, but that was really a life-altering experience for me, because it wasn't like I didn't know that there were people who had attempted and survived. I mean, clearly that is something else, but really the only thing that I really knew about from my personal experience was loss, and I didn't know the other side. And so it was really important for me. So I shifted somewhere in there toward people who had survived. And I did talk to families. I did talk to families of people who had lost people too, because that's a really significant piece when you don't want to feel alone, for both. And what was really tricky a little bit for me, for us when we were putting this together, was how, and Sally, the work you're doing with Survivors United, am I calling it the right thing?
Yep, United Survivors, yep.
United Survivors that helped me a lot, I have to say, because for us, it was when we were putting the film together, and when you talk to somebody who has attempted suicide and has ideated, or you know, anybody who is thinking about it, what you don't want to say to somebody is, well, there's nothing you can do. And you don't necessarily say that to somebody who's lost somebody, but in a weird way, certainly when I was younger, I did want to hear that. I did want to hear, well, you couldn't, not that I believed it, because survivor guilt is something that will be with me forever, but there's a way to talk to people who have lost people to suicide, and there's a way to talk to people who have attempted and survived. And there is a common way, but it's really, really, I think it is really difficult and tricky. That's why the work you're doing is so important, because it isn't mutually exclusive. And oftentimes, you know, we do know that people who have lost people to suicide can be more vulnerable to thinking about it themselves or attempting themselves. So that was a difficult turn in the film too, when we talk to a family of somebody who had lost people to suicide, but we're also seeing people who have survived. And I think it is a tricky thing. And I will, at some point, I don't know if you want me to do it now, I have an anecdote from a previous screening that we did with somebody who had lost somebody.
Yeah, hold on to that thought, because I got about six thoughts in my head. I just want to respond before I forget everything. So the piece of starting as a loss survivor and then finding, you know, your way in this journey to the attempt survivor community is a path that we share. And, you know, I started in the loss survivor community for my own grief support and, you know, was in support groups with loss survivors and found that incredibly powerful piece of connection and a holding space, really, for people to hear stories over and over again that are really hard to hear. The survivor community, at least the ones that I was connected to, really helped tremendously in that transition through the grief. And then I found myself at AAS, American Association of Suicidology Conference, and got connected to the, you know, the experts and the thought leaders and all that stuff. But it really has been my journey into connecting with the suicide attempt survivor and lived experience communities that has completely fueled my heart and passion for this work. And they've also been getting organized and consolidated and, you know, focused in this time period that you and I have been working. So that's been exciting to see them too in terms of a social movement for them to, you know, develop different ways of coming together and how to support one another and how to put unified messages forward and all of that. So the organization that you mentioned that we've just been launching recently is called United Suicide Survivors International. And the whole idea is to bring together loss survivors, attempt survivors, people who live with thoughts and feelings around suicide, friends and family who've been through it, and even allies who maybe don't consider themselves personally touched by the issue, but really want to be part of the movement, bringing us all together as a united community, locking arms in solidarity to, you know, put forth our stories and our passion to change culture and systems, to be more compassionate and empowering of people going through these darkest times. So your film really kind of also reflects that, you know, people aren't neatly packaged into one box either, that they have experienced loss and also attempts, and that this whole community can really be pulled together. So go ahead and share your anecdote.
Oh, well, so when we screened the film in Marin County, a man stood up after we showed it and talked about, basically said that his daughter 9 years ago had jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge and did not survive. And it really became the Q&A, I mean, talking about it really became, as it should have, I mean, about that. And then people got up and it really became much more of sort of a group therapy session where people really felt the need to talk and be heard. And it isn't like I didn't know that would happen, because that would happen sometimes, but I think I was a little like, oh my God, of course, because that's what we're trying to do. I mean, we're not just putting the statistics out there, and we know it's a template and concept, but we know, you know, I mean, those are things that, you know, we can learn, but to sort of see the humanity behind this and to let people tell their stories and to hear the stories and, you know, just realize, wait, I'm not alone. But for him, it was really difficult to see the stories of people who had survived, and he was really honest about that. And I mean, there is a huge story about somebody who lost their son, about a family who lost their son and brother to suicide as well. And he, you know, sort of related to that, but it was difficult for him to see that. And I think that is going to be something that's going to come up too, because yes, I mean, there are people who, and those are the people whose stories are so valuable. I didn't, when I started this and then when I was talking to them, I can honestly say, and I don't know if I would have felt this way 30 years ago, but I felt this way as I was doing this was, wow, maybe I can not learn what my brother was thinking, but get some mm-hmm. ideas, some clues, some things. You know, I was really gathering information and really trying to do this. Obviously, I was as a human being and a sister and a daughter, and those were emotional moments for sure. But when I really tried to turn on the journalistic work, it was like, whoa, we can really, really get something out of this. But, you know, it's going to be difficult, I think, too.
Yeah, I know that's a lot what I heard, too, when I first came into the field and went to the conference. And I said, you know, where are the people who have lived through this? Where are the suicide attempt survivors? And I heard, you know, that their stories are triggering for lost survivors. And so they're not out here. And we haven't created a home for them yet. And I thought, well, that's a shame. Give us an opportunity
yep.
maybe to get to know one another and to figure out how best to support one another. And, you know, over the decade that I've been with the AAS, that has unfolded. And so I'm really excited to see where that takes us. But I think both sides, you know, need to have empathy and patience for each other. And I also think, you know, people come into this at different places in their journey. So sometimes when it's super raw, when it's super new, it's hard to breathe. You know, it's hard to eat, let alone kind of integrate all of this other information. And I think at some point, when we have a little bit more perspective and we've made some meaning and we've done a lot of reflecting on things, then it's easier perhaps to look at somebody else's experience and learn from it. So speaking of learning, let's shift our conversation to the second part of the podcast focus, which is really about the science. I really, in my effort in this podcast, I'm really trying to blend all the different ways that we gather knowledge and how that informs what we as a community can do differently. And your particular piece of this is truly unique in that you are blending, you know, an art with a proven strategy that we know impacts people's attitudes, compassion, and empathy. Can you share a little bit about some of the research, some of the science that have informed your approach or that you've learned about through this process of being involved with both films of Two Minds and The S Word? What are some of the things that you've learned?
A lot. probably on this film, at least a year of research prior to actually filming and then throughout. And a lot of the people who I spoke with, I mean, it was interesting because there were varying views and, you know, some of the viewpoints were, I'm not going to hear 90% mental illness or 95% mental illness. It's 99.9% mental illness. And that's why people kill themselves. So that's one viewpoint.
Can you explain that finding a little bit more? Because I think that's something that most of our audience won't know of. So could you share a little bit more what you're talking about there with the 90 to 99% is attributed to mental illness? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in talking to, you know, a psychologist and a psychiatrist about sort of, it's so weird to say cause of suicide, just because we're talking about so many different factors and we can't simplify it. But there are, I did speak with one or two doctors who said, you know, and it talked about various things, you know, I mean, there's hopelessness, you know, just feeling like there's nothing or that you're a burden on other people. And there are all of these things, but he said that, you know, at the end of the day, it still is about mental illness, whether it's bipolar disorder, which again, that was something I learned in the filming that in filming of Two Minds. And again, it's science that I learned that could be different, and it could be, you know, it could certainly be argued. But when they talk about bipolar condition being the number one cause, if you will, of suicide being like in the mixed state, which is when you have mania, you have enough mania and enough depression, because I say that it's, again, this is all, you know, based on people who I've talked to. So when I say it, I'm not telling, you know, I'm not telling you as the authoritarian. I just want to make sure that, yeah, when somebody's like, well, what does that filmmaker know? But so these are based on actual scientists who I talk about, who I talk to. So when they say that you know, depression, when people think, God, they're so depressed, they're going to kill themselves, it's a rare thing, supposedly, because when you're truly, truly depressed, it's difficult to even get out of bed or to move. And when you're manic, sometimes the mania is happy. Sometimes, you know, it's a lot, it presents itself in a lot of different ways. But when they're mixed together, when you're depressed enough, but you have enough mania to motivate you, that could be a very prime time for something like suicide. So
yeah,
my brother
was definitely in a mixed state in the last few weeks of his life, and I remember watching him go through this, and I thought, this is what a tortured soul looks like. He, you know, he couldn't sleep, and he would pace around the house. And he would drink, you know, pots of coffee and chain smoke, and he had a tremor in his hand. And he was also so filled, so really agitated and on edge, and at the same time completely filled with self-loathing and hatred and regret. And, you know, it was so painful to watch him. There was nothing we could do to console him. And I felt like that is hell. That is a living hell, that mixed state of bipolar condition. And you know, it's understandable someone in that much emotional and psychological pain would consider, like, I can't cope with this any longer, you know? So it makes sense to me why that is a big contributor, or that at that stage of the illness, that's when people are most vulnerable to suicide, because it's just so horrific.
Absolutely. How do you navigate through that? But then there are other people who say, you know, it's like, you know, it is something that, because you're talking about teenagers, you're talking about, I mean, suicide is one of the few things that absolutely does not discriminate. So it doesn't matter where you're from or how old you are or anything. Obviously, there are certain groups that are more vulnerable than others. But people do talk about trauma and childhood trauma, which, you know, we talk about a little bit in the film. People talk about their situations where perhaps there is not a diagnosed mental illness. Maybe it isn't about that. So I think that as far as that goes, I probably left a little bit more confused than I was before.
Mm-hmm.
Just because, you know, because that's sort of what happens with science. It just keeps going and you just keep learning more. And I think that I learned a lot, but a lot of what I learned sort of crossed each other. So it's like, yes, it's definitely mental illness. It's definitely not mental illness. It's definitely trauma. Well, it's definitely, you know, so
right.
It's all over the map, I think, is what I learned.
I've come to a place too where I'm like, you know, a lot of these explanations or a lot of these paradigms for understanding the suicidal mind are really based within the experience of the person. So it's them who live with the mental illness. It's them who have experienced trauma. And I have now come to a place where I'm like, let's talk about what are the social determinants that lead people to these places. It's not just about a broken human. It's about the fact that, you know, we do some pretty horrible things to people, you know, and poverty, and economic changes.
Yep.
And marginalization and discrimination and all of these things are incredibly isolating for people and have powerful impacts on their ability to feel like they have a purpose and that they have connection, which we know are huge determinants of suicide risk. So it's interesting how that conversation about these contributing factors has also shifted, you know, in the last few years. And not that one's wrong and one's right. It's just the complexity of this continues to evolve. What about go ahead.
No, I was going to say, because people do want a simple answer. It happened,
right.
And then this. But I think the focus, it seems to me, the focus needs to be to not that it isn't there, but you know, people talk about suicide prevention and all of this stuff. A wise person told me about something called, you may know about this upstream, downstream.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
About
this
whole,
one of my Oh, yeah. I talk
yeah, I'll
about
bet.
It all the time. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of like, duh, how did I not know? But right. So if you want to explain it and then I can talk about it, because you'll probably explain it more intelligently than me, because I literally, I've just been talking about it and now it's become my adaptive thing that I'm just think is so amazing.
Yeah, I'll just briefly, you know, when most people hear suicide prevention, they are thinking crisis intervention. So they're thinking about the point where the person's, you know, on the brink. And that is certainly part of the equation. And thank goodness we have great resources like the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline and the Crisis Text Fund and so forth that to help people at that moment. All we're focused on, a lot of people will miss a lot of people, first of all. And there's just a lot of pain and despair that far, what we call downstream. And so if we can get upstream from that crisis, if we can look at what happens before that, the things that we need to put in place, maybe at first thought, the first time the thought of suicide enters the mind, or when that a level of distress is becoming slightly unmanageable, or even more upstream than that, what are the things that we can put into place earlier in life that build resilience and protective factors so possibly that person never has to get to the point of feeling suicidal despair because of the things that we did earlier to protect them from that. And so that's the gist. And we will save a lot more people and prevent a lot more despair if we focus on upstream things. But we are a very crisis-oriented culture, so it's very hard to kind of shift the focus upstream.
Right, that's exactly. And yeah, the beautiful thing about something like suicide is you need it all. So things like the crisis line and tech line and all of that are just, they're critical because I don't know that it's all going to change that quickly. But when you talk about like talking to like Dr. April Foreman or Dr. Bill Schmidt or Sally Spencer Thomas, when you talk to these people about creating a life worth living, sort of the upstream stuff, it seems like that is more what we need to be doing, which is kind of like really changing society. Leah Harris talks about it in the film too. It's like we need to change. A lot of stuff needs to change, and that's so big. I mean, that's a huge scope, and that is, you know, beyond suicide prevention. It's just about a lot of things. It's policy. It's everything. So if we can just do that real quick and just change everything, then I think we're on a really good path.
Right. I wish it was that easy. So I want to do this last part of the interview to really focus on what our listeners can do differently. And, you know, this podcast is going to air shortly before things are getting really ramped up in our schools and communities and workplaces around Suicide Prevention Month, World Suicide Prevention Day, National Suicide Prevention Week, which is, you know, always falls in September every year. And so I was wondering if you had some tips or strategies or things that you've learned about communication around suicide or mental health issues, but probably suicide in particular, communication things that are effective. And storytelling in particular, are there any tips or pitfalls that you can help people avoid? What are the main things you'd like the listeners to know so that when they're out there doing their work around Kating, around suicide, they're doing it in the most safe and effective way?
Yeah, I think, I mean, clearly talking about it and not letting stuff fester and not, you know, I think is really important. And having said that, how you talk about it, and I know you made a reference earlier to 13 Reasons Why, and I'm not even going to go into that, but it's the idea of how you talk to somebody and whether it's thinking it's somebody else's fault or that you feel a certain way or all of that. But just knowing that there is an environment or people, having your safe people, because particularly when you're talking about like middle school and even, you know, high school, it's like there are people who aren't as safe. I mean, there are people who you can tell stuff to who may not hold that the same way. And it's a lot of stuff to navigate, but it's figuring out who you can trust and who you can talk to and just keeping the conversation open and talking about stuff, because not talking about it, you know, it's just that whole thing about nothing heals in the dark, which is, you know, I've just found to be so true. And so that's something. And then were you going to ask something else? Because I'm thinking
Well, so that's on the individual level. We really,
right.
As a field, we do emphasize that this is a secret that's too big to keep. And I love your quote, "Nothing heals in the dark," that, you know, finding that trusting person to kind of share the load of your despair and burden and share that with you makes the lift much lighter. And this is true for all kinds of life challenges, whether it's divorce or grief and loss or whatever, is that when we share our life challenges, they're just lighter for each of us. And we can take turns in that. Like, you can help me through something and I can help you through something later on. So talking about it and talking about it directly, not just the superficial things that we might say are contributing to it, like a failed grade or whatever, but really acknowledging the darkness of it, the fact that you're thinking about dying of suicide. These are important things to share with, like, a therapist or a trusted mentor or a best friend, someone that you know. Receive these conversations with empathy and compassion. But I'm actually more interested in your thoughts about public communication. And as we head into this month where people will be doing these different educational programs and communication campaigns, what have you learned about how best to communicate to spread positive messages about hope and resilience and recovery and compassion and so forth through your work in making this film and the things you've learned about through storytelling and communication research?
Well, I think the focus is so, and when you talk about the one thing that I kept thinking about, like when you were talking about like August and September and just thinking about the pressure and and how it's escalated over the years, pressure in high school, like, you know, you're in ninth grade and you're thinking about, oh my God, what college am I going to go? What am I going to? So I think it, you know, and again, it's easy to blame the parents or the teachers or the, you know, it's maybe if we like take the blame away a little bit and just try to think about how we can sort of talk to our kids, deal with our kids from a place of, you know, it's not about kumbaya, like, screw grades, it's all going to be fine, we can just kind of, you know, commune with nature and not really worry about stuff. But finding a way to, you know, you're going back to school and you're learning and you're doing the things, but you know, if it is that sort of approach of, oh my God, what did you get on your side? You've got to get this. You've got to do it's that dogged sort of, you know, I have to achieve, whether it's at your job or your school or your thing. And I didn't want to necessarily go there with social media, which is the elephant in every room, because I think it is a double-edged sword. I think there's a lot of good. I think a lot of good stuff is happening, and I think people are communicating with each other on social media, and I think a lot of that is good. But if you wake up every morning and worry about how many likes you have and how many, you know, how people received your Instagram photo, you know, whatever that is, I mean, I don't know how to close Pandora's box, and I don't even want to, but if there is a way to figure out, and I wish that I had the answer. I mean, I have my own answers that I do at home that aren't always popular, but but if there is a way to, again, you can't stop it. You can't, just like when people say, take 13 Reasons Why off the air. No, I mean, you can't do that. It's like, this has happened. Now, how do we go forward? Just like, and it's almost like, I'm going to ramble here for a second, but it's like, I learned this from John Draper of the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. It's like, you just like, you can't tell somebody, no, don't think about suicide. No, that's
right.
Not really how
right.
You're feeling. Yes. Yeah. You know what? It is. Okay. So you're thinking this way. Okay. Suicide is an option. It just is. But what are five other options? What are five other ways to approach, you know, to approach that? And if we can somehow, because I feel like as much as our world is opening, it's also closing at the same time. Like, again, something like social media, it's like, okay, there's no reason to go outside and there's no reason to go on a hike because I can just, I have it all here. Or I can just go see a 3D, you know, I can do the virtual reality. Somebody said to me the other day that they didn't feel that they had to go to Paris, even though they've always wanted to go, because pretty soon they'll be able to watch it in a virtual reality way. And that is, you know, again, it's kind of like, okay, well, that's going to save on travel expenses for sure. But is that really the way we want to do things? So I think, you know, again, I don't know if I'm answering your question, but I just feel like we just have to open things up a little bit and give people sort of the space to be able to talk and to understand and not feel like everything is a pressure or everything is, you know, how much of this or who likes me, like, again, because when you talk about something like that or even bullying, which has been going on since the beginning of time, when you escalate anything like that with something like social media, where from one person pushing you and taking your lunch to 1,000, it does, you know, it hurts and it impacts, and it really is about talking to our kids and, you know, sort of starting from the ground up. I don't know if that answers the question,
you know,
but
no, it's super important. I think, you know, the public communication about, you know, being mindful of our expectations for ourselves and the people we love, because one of the things that I'm learning about with the men in the middle year increase in suicide in particular has to do with these crushed expectations that they had this certain vision of that they were only worthy. They're only worthy if they reach the certain amount of achievement or this certain amount of money. And if they can't do that, they're not a worthy human. So these are really important things. Before I wrap up here, I want you to share with the listeners how do they get involved with the S Word? How could they bring this to their community? How could they learn more about you? And how do they access Of Two Minds? What are some ways that they can get to know your work?
Well, thank you for asking that. Can I say one thing to what you just said about men in the middle? I do, again, have to just tell you how much I appreciate the fact that you talk about that stuff, because oftentimes, again, downstream, when people talk about men taking their own lives more than women, you know, getting to that point, they talk about guns, which I think is huge, and I would love to see them all go away, but that's for another conversation. But when you talk about, so again, you're talking about sort of the method as opposed to what is bringing them to that point. So I appreciate the fact that it's both of those things. But to answer your question, we would love for people to get involved, and we want to show the film. Like when people ask me where we want to show it, and I say everywhere, I really do mean that, because yes, we have our community of people who've lost people to suicide or have attempted suicide, or they're in the psychiatric profession and all of that, and that's great, and those are people for sure. But beyond that, I don't know anybody over the age of whatever, unfortunately it's getting younger, who doesn't know somebody who's been impacted by this. Mm-hmm. So we do want to show it everywhere, and we're going to premiere it in September, but we would like to show it at every college, high school. And the way to get involved is if you go to our website, which is www.thesswordmovie.com, or our Facebook page, which is at Suidoc. All of that will become clear of how you can sort of get in touch with us. We want more stories too, and we continue to collect stories. We collect stories, whether they're written. We're going to start collecting right now. We're putting stories up on our website and our Facebook page of sort of the stuff that ended up on the cutting room floor, because, you know, we shot like 150 hours, and I just cannot imagine somebody sitting through 150 hours in a movie theater. And so we're doing that. But we also are going to be encouraging people to send their stories, whether it's like a one or two, not that you can tell your whole life story in 2 minutes, but a 1 or 2 minute, maybe five selfie that we can put up too, because every story is important. Just because it's not in the movie doesn't mean it wasn't important to us at all. It's just, you know, trying to keep something under 90 minutes. But yes, so we would love people to get, again, any way, you know, if you want to just talk to us, we're there. And if you want to show the film in your community, all of that, if you go to the website and email us, you know, all of that, which is, that's all doable.
The S Word Movie.com. And if they want to know more about Of Two Minds, where do they go?
Of Two Minds. I should have probably come with that. I think that might be Of Two Minds Movie.com, I hope.
All right.
I'm pretty sure that's what that is. Yeah.
Yep.
I think that's what that is.
I'll put it in the show notes for sure. All right, so to wrap it up, we have been talking for the last hour about communication and storytelling as it relates to suicide prevention and mental health promotion. And our guest, Lisa Klein, the incredible filmmaker of The S Word and Of Two Minds, kind of sharing her story of how she got into the work as well as lessons that she's learned along the way. We talked about safe messaging and appropriate language to use around these topics, and how storytelling impacts our thoughts and feelings and community and ultimately reduces the stigma that perpetuates so much of the problem that we're seeing. We talked about how to talk to kids, which is an experience that both Lisa and I have shared as loss survivors. How do we explain these things to our young children, and some resources that can help with that. We both talked about how we've been inspired by the suicide attempt survivor community in particular, a number of people that have really come forward with their stories and projects and books that I think are really moving us in a new direction that is far more empowering and exciting than I have experienced in the last decade. We talked a little bit about contributing factors, how mental illness like bipolar and depression contribute, but also trauma. Personal trauma like abuse and combat and assault, as well as community trauma like different forms of discrimination. We talked about resources like the crisis line and the text line. We talked about individual communication, how important it is for people to find safe people in their life that can be part of their safety net, part of their support network, so they don't have to go through these struggles alone. And we talked about public communication, bringing things like the S Word movie to your community to open up these conversations, knowing that we can't take suicide away as an option for people, that that's always going to be there for some people. How do we inspire them to stay, as Desiree would say, stay and find their way back to a passion for living? So I've been so excited about this interview, and I'm thrilled to be connected with you, and I look forward to the many ways that we continue to work together. At least I feel like we're peas in a pod. I will put all this together, and we can promote it through our different networks. I want to thank you for giving an hour of your day to create this with me. I want to thank the listeners for joining us and learning about these important things around communication. For more of the episodes for the Hope Illuminated podcast, please subscribe, and you can do that by going to my website, sallyspencerthomas.com. And I'm running a little contest as we're getting going in this first year that I'll be giving a $100 Amazon gift card for people who subscribe to the podcast, leave a rating and review on iTunes, and also to who subscribe to my newsletter. Through the newsletter, you'll find out about upcoming podcasts that we're having. I've got a great lineup coming up in the next few months. I also host Twitter chats and have a newsletter where we pull all this together. So if you're interested in how we can create communities that are more compassionate and support people, not only through these difficult times, but provide the kinds of support and purpose making that prevent people from landing in suicidal despair in the first place. So that said, any closing thoughts, Lisa, as we wrap up here?
Well, thank you so much for including me in this and for being a part of it. And I really, really appreciate this. And I want that Amazon gift card. So I'm now focused on going and signing up for your thing. And hopefully moving forward, we're going to change the world.
Very good. So I'll close with my motto. Let's all open our hearts, challenge our thinking, and take action to save lives. Together, we can restore dignity and sustain a passion for living. Thanks, everybody.
At Boar's Head, we place a premium on authenticity. And the home-roasted flavor of our Ever-Roast chicken is no exception. Inspired by a medley of ingredients from the garden, a family recipe, and slow-roasted Kraft. It's the authentic taste of home and the unmatched quality of Boar's Head. Ever roast chicken, sliced fresh at the deli. Only from Boar's Head. Compromise elsewhere.
Progressive presents Mind Flowness with Flo.
Before you lies a beautiful meadow. In that meadow, Progressive Direct has placed its auto insurance rates alongside those of competitors. You select the lowest rate and feel a great sense of calm. A great sense of...
Compare Progressive Direct rates with competitors' rates so you can rest easy. Visit Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.